So I want to talk about toys for a minute, switching gears slightly. And for our younger members that are here this morning, think about your favorite toy at home or a favorite toy you had when you were a kid, up to our older members as well. I want you to think about the purpose of toys, the nature of toys and why we play with them. And I want you to think about the sorts of things that we play with. So when I was growing up, my favorite toys were Transformers. It was great. A child of the 80s, and it's been great the last few years to see them brought to life on the big screen. Toy companies making movies, they're something you never thought you'd see. And Transformers were great. They were these things that could become robots into trucks, into fighter jets, into aircraft carriers. They were awesome. You may have played with cars, or you may have played the game Operation, practicing it being a doctor on that game board, or you played Monopoly. Everything that we play with, every toy that we have, mimics something in the real world. And the thing that makes the toy great is that it's safe and that we're in control of it. The toy, generally speaking, unless it's an air rifle because you'll shoot your eye out, isn't something that can really do any harm. But even think about the air rifle, it mimics a much more powerful thing that is not a toy. And then we grow up, and oftentimes the things that we interact with in the real world are copies and echoes of the toys that we played with, and now they come with danger and responsibility. Toys are safe. We like toys. We're in control of our toys, and so we love to play with them. But we forget oftentimes that they mimic the real world. This morning we're going to visit a familiar story. These stories start to sound familiar. My dad was a fan of the Far Side comic, and there's a great one where it's the writers for the show Bewitched sitting around the table for their weekly brainstorming session, and one of them is saying, I've got an idea for this week. Elnora will put some sort of curse on Daryl, and nobody will be able to figure out what's going on until Samantha does at the end of the episode and sets everything right. Which, if you ever watch the show Bewitched, is every episode of Bewitched. There was no variety in the plot. It was the same thing week after week, misspent youth watching Nick at Night. The stories in Numbers start to feel a little bit like that. I've got an idea for this week's story. The people of Israel will grumble and complain about something. God will get upset. Moses will intervene and everything will work out all right in the end, but a lot of people will die before it's all over. That's pretty much every story from Exodus all the way to Numbers. And it forces us to wrestle with the question of what is the purpose of repeating this over and over again? Couldn't Moses have just written down one of these occasions as the test case? But as I'm going through, I'm finding that each one highlights a different aspect of what God is trying to do with his people and where his people are missing the point. And so we're going to be in Numbers 16 and 17 this week. I'm going to move through the story quickly and then draw some applications at the end. Number 16, verse 1. Now Korah, the son of Izhar, son of Kohath, son of Levi, and Dathan and Abiram, sons of Eliab, and On, the son of Peleth, sons of Reuben, took men. And they rose up before Moses with a number of the people of Israel, 250 chiefs of the congregation, chosen from the assembly, well-known men. They assembled themselves together against Moses and Aaron and said to them, "You have gone too far. For all in the congregation are holy, every one of them, and Yahweh is among them. Why then do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of Yahweh?" We've got two things going on here. We have a group of Levites, and then separately a group of Reubenites, and they are rising up against Moses and against Aaron. It becomes clear the Levites are primarily targeting Aaron and Aaron's status as the high priest. The Reubenites seem to be targeting Moses and his political and military and judicial authority over the assembly of the people of Israel. Reuben, you remember, was the firstborn, but had lost out on the inheritance rights, had lost out on that privilege because of their forefathers' sin, and the tribe has lost its place of prominence. And so it makes sense that they would be agitating for more political authority. But this phrase that they use, "you have gone too far," as the ESV renders it, literally it reads, "great to you." In other words, you've made something great of yourselves. You have exalted yourselves, as they say later. You've made much of yourselves in a way that is not appropriate. And he uses this interesting language. Everyone in the congregation is holy. Yahweh is in our midst collectively. Who are you that you exalt yourself over and against us? And so this has all of the makings of an authority showdown, a power struggle. Who's going to be in charge, Moses or the Reubenites, Aaron or the Levites? And they couch it in these kind of democratic terms. They're arguing for a equality, a democratic sort of system. And they've gathered together these 250 chiefs. They've got the people of influence behind them. And they ask, why then do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of Yahweh? Now notice what happens. Exalt literally means to raise up. And in verse 4, when Moses heard it, he fell on his face. Again, right out the gate, whenever the people of Israel or any subset of them grumble or complain, it becomes apparent immediately that it is an invalid complaint. Moses has not exalted himself. Remember, he didn't even want the job at the beginning. He tried every which way to get out of doing this thing. He's tried to get out of it since then as well, and God simply won't let him. And so he falls on his face, a posture of humility. And he said to Korah and all his company, the Levites, in the morning, Yahweh will show who his is and who is holy and will bring him near to him. The one whom he chooses, he will bring near to him. This idea of being brought near is repeated throughout this chapter. It's at the core of what's going on. The Levites and the Reubenites are suggesting that Moses and Aaron have claimed a special status, that somehow they are closer to God than everyone else, and that they want in on that privileged position. And Moses says, interestingly, not defending his authority. He doesn't start by explaining, no, the burning bush thing, I was chosen by God, and that's... He immediately deflects. He immediately defers to God's sovereignty and says, in the morning, Yahweh will settle this. He doesn't engage in the argument. He doesn't defend himself. He simply falls on his face in a posture of humility and says, God will sort this out, and he will bring near to him those whom he chooses. So he prescribes this formula. Do this. Take censers, Korah and all his company. Those are the things that they would burn incense in, waving before the Ark of the Testimony, which if you haven't had a chance to look at the tabernacle set up in the foyer, please go out and check that out. Glenn finally got it assembled, and it's something to engage with. Take censers, Korah and all his company. Put fire in them and put incense on them before Yahweh tomorrow. And the man whom Yahweh chooses shall be the Holy One. You have gone too far, sons of Levi. Moses throws that same phrase back in their face and says, you have made much of yourselves, you sons of Levi. You have appropriated for yourself something that is not yours. And Moses said to Korah, hear now, you sons of Levi, is it too small a thing for you that the God of Israel has separated you from the congregation of Israel to bring you near to himself, to do service in the tabernacle of Yahweh and to stand before the congregation to minister to them, and that he has brought you near him and all your brothers, the sons of Levi, with you? And would you seek the priesthood also? Therefore, it is against Yahweh that you and all your company have gathered together. What is Aaron that you grumble against him? The way that Moses engages with this is very interesting. He submits the whole thing to Yahweh, says Yahweh will bring near those who he will bring near, and he'll settle this. But then he does take issue with what they have said, and he uses this, it's the opposite of the phrase, great to you, you have gone too far. Is it too small a thing? It's literally, is it little to you? Is it small to you? Is it unimportant to you what God has already done? And Moses here again indicates that even their accusation that only Moses is the one that's been brought near is baseless. He says over and over again to them, he has brought you near. You have been invited as Levites to minister in the tabernacle, to serve the sacred space of God that guards his presence in our midst. You have an immense privilege. Is it a trivial thing for you? Are you minimizing what God has already given you? In going too far, they have minimized what God has done. Is it a small thing? Is it small to you what God has done? And then he interacts with these Reubenites, and he calls Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, and they said, "We will not come up." They won't even respond to Moses' summons to come and have this thing settled out. They're going to stay in the camp. And now they ask the same question. Is it a small thing, little to you, that you have brought us up out of a land flowing with milk and honey? Referring to Egypt. And the language is intentional. To kill us in the wilderness, that you must also make yourself a prince over us? Moreover, you have not brought us into a land flowing with milk and honey, nor given us inheritance of fields and vineyards. Will you put out the eyes of these men? We will not come up. And so they accuse Moses straight up of saying, you failed. You brought us out of a land that was flowing with milk and honey. We're dying in this wilderness, and you haven't brought us into a land flowing with milk and honey. You haven't delivered us fields and inheritances. And of course, they have temporary amnesia. Because Moses isn't the reason that they've not been brought into a land flowing with milk and honey. They messed that up all by themselves, as we talked about last week. They are the reason that this has not worked out so far, but they bring the charge against Moses, and they suggest that he has taken advantage of their desperate situation for his own gain. And so verse 15, Moses was very angry and said to Yahweh, notice he does not engage in this argument with them. He just goes straight to God and says, don't respect their offering. I have not taken one donkey from them, and I have not harmed one of them. Moses protests his innocence directly to God, not to his accusers. And there is wisdom in that. And Moses said to Korah, be present, you and all your company, before Yahweh, you and they and Aaron tomorrow, and let every one of you take his censer and put incense on it, and every one of you bring before, literally draw near Yahweh with his censer. 250 censers, you also and Aaron, each his censer. And if you remember the story of Nadab and Abihu that we looked at in the spring, what's going on is that Moses is challenging them, saying, if you think that we have usurped this position, that it rightly belongs to you, then let's find out. Walk into the tabernacle with your censer and see how that works. Because only the people that God has designated, only the people that have been sanctified as worthy to enter that space are going to survive entering that space. Nadab and Abihu found that out the hard way, if you recall that story. And so he's saying, if you think you're the rightful priest, then come on in. Try it. We'll see. So every man took his censer, verse 18, and put fire in them and laid incense on them and stood at the entrance of the tent of meeting with Moses and Aaron. Then Korah assembled all the congregation against them at the entrance of the tent of meeting, and the glory of Yahweh appeared to all the congregation. God again manifests his presence visibly, and again I find myself scratching my head. How do they rebel in the face of God's obvious presence? And Yahweh spoke to Moses and to Aaron, saying, separate yourselves from among this congregation, that I may consume them in a moment. And they fell on their faces and said, O God, the God of the spirits of all flesh, shall one man sin, and will you be angry with all the congregation? And Yahweh spoke to Moses, saying, say to the congregation, get away from the dwelling of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. And so we've got Levites at the tent of meeting, we've got Reubenites in the camp, all gathered in rebellion. The congregation is gathered together seemingly in support of those rebelling. And God says, I'm going to wipe them all out. And Moses is falling on his face again, interceding. Then Moses rose and went to Dathan and Abiram, and the elders of Israel followed him. And he spoke to the congregation, saying, depart, please, from the tents of these wicked men and touch nothing of theirs, lest you be swept away with all their sins. There's a separation taking place. Those who will align themselves with God and those who will rebel against his purposes. So they got away from the dwelling of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. And Dathan and Abiram came out and stood at the door of their tents together with their wives, their sons, and their little ones. And Moses said, hereby you shall know that Yahweh has sent me to do all these works, and that it has not been of my own accord. Again, he's not defending himself. He didn't want the job. He was dragged kicking and screaming into this role. If these men die as all men die, or if they are visited by the fate of all mankind, then Yahweh has not sent me. But if Yahweh creates something new and the ground opens its mouth and swallows them up with all that belongs to them and they go down alive into Sheol, then you shall know that these men have despised Yahweh. I hope you're picking up as we move through this story that at issue here is not Moses' authority. At issue here is not Aaron's role as priest. Moses and God together are taking great pains to demonstrate that that is not the issue. At issue is Yahweh's authority. and Yahweh's role in this congregation. And God makes it clear that it is He that these rebels have despised. What Moses said at the beginning, what is Aaron that you grumble against him, is true. They're not really grumbling against Aaron. They are grumbling against God. And this is very different from the way authority worked at this time in history in the ancient world. If this had been any other ancient ruler, he simply would have said, God chose me, and that's the end of the discussion. And anyone who says differently, I will take care of personally. Moses is operating in a very different fashion when his authority is challenged by deferring to God and saying, really, this is an issue you have with God. It's not an issue you have with me. And as soon as he had finished speaking all these words, verse 31, the ground under them split apart and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up with their households and all the people who belonged to Korah and all their goods. So they and all that belonged to them went down alive into Sheol, and the earth closed over them, and they perished from the midst of the assembly. And all Israel who were around them fled at their cry, for they said, lest the earth swallow us up. And fire came out from Yahweh and consumed the 250 men offering the incense. God deals with both groups, swallows them up, consumes them, to demonstrate His position and role in the community. The story does not end there. Yahweh spoke to Moses, saying, tell Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, to take up the censers out of the blaze. Go get those fire pans out of the blaze and scatter the fire far and wide, because they have become holy. As for the censers of these men who have sinned at the cost of their lives, let them be made into hammered plates as a covering for the altar. For they offered them before Yahweh and they became holy. Thus they shall be a sign to the people of Israel. A sign of what? A sign to remind the people that drawing near to God's presence is not something that can be done casually. It is not something that we have an inherent right to do. It is something that God must make provision for. God must sanctify us. God must change us before we can enter His presence with the confidence that the author of Hebrews talks about. Verse 40 talks about the reminder that no outsider who is not of the descendants of Aaron should draw near, that phrase again, to burn incense, lest he become like Korah and his company. And Aaron knew this full well. He had watched his two sons perish for trespassing into the presence of God without permission. And the story is not yet over yet. In the verse 41, the congregation grumbles against Moses and Aaron, accusing them of killing the Lord's people. They put Korah's death and the death of all of the Reubenites, these rebels, on Moses' hands. And so they assemble against Moses and against Aaron. And again, the glory of God appears and descends in front of the tent of meeting. And God again threatens to wipe out the entire congregation. And a plague breaks out. And Aaron now takes a censer and fills it with fire and goes and stands in the midst of the congregation, standing between the dead and the living as the plague progresses, making intercession and stopping the plague. But not before, in verse 49, 14,700 were killed beside those who had died in the affair of Korah. And it's Aaron's actions that stop the plague. This rebellion of Korah gets mentioned one other place in Scripture, and it's in Jude 11. Jude comparing false teachers in his time with these folks. Woe to them, for they walked in the way of Cain and abandoned themselves for the sake of gain to Balaam's error and perished in Korah's rebellion. We've talked about Cain. We're talking this morning about Korah. In a couple of weeks, we'll talk about Balaam. And it's interesting that Jude lumps these three together, comparing them to false teachers. And when you ask the question, what do these three have in common? What is it that's going on in Korah's rebellion? What is the error that he and his compatriots make? Here's what it is. Cain, Korah, and Balaam all make the same mistake. They think that God is like the deities of their day, that can be bought, that can be manipulated, that can be controlled for their own ends. The sons of Korah look at Aaron as priest and say, he's got his hand on the lever of power. Because he and Moses are in charge, they wield God's authority and can use it however they want, and that's unfair, and it should belong to us. And that's why they say, great to you. You've taken this upon yourselves, this position, and it should belong to us. And it's why Moses says, is it too small a thing what God has done, that he has deigned to draw near to you? Moses and Aaron have a correct view of God's position and sovereignty to say to them, you've got this thing backwards. We didn't approach God and obtain some privilege by some sort of persuasion, by some sort of manipulation that we now wield God's power. It's the other way around. God wields us. We are in his hands. We can do nothing but what he instructs us. Cain thought that by bringing an offering, that would be enough to get him on God's good side. And he didn't understand that you must come with a surrendered heart, a heart that seeks God's glory and not your own good. It was his lack of faith that condemns his offering. Balaam thought that the word of God could be purchased for a price, that he could get God to undo his own good purposes and promises for cash. Korah and the sons of Reuben are after gain, and they perceive the authority that Moses and Aaron have as a way of getting at that. And they've made the same mistake that Nadab and Abihu made in coming before God's presence. And we remember what Moses said to Aaron after that episode. This is what Yahweh has said. Among those who are near me, I will be sanctified. And before all the people, I will be glorified. God's purpose is to make much of himself. And only those who will be drawn near to God and his perfection for his sake will be allowed to remain. Those who come with their own agenda, those who come seeking their own ends, will be consumed. Because there is only one kingdom, his kingdom. And if we're trying to establish our own kingdom, it will perish. And so this story ends. There's a final test where Aaron is told to bring his staff and the staffs of 12 tribal leaders before the tent, and they plant them in the ground, and the next day Aaron's staff has produced almond branches and blossoms and ripe almond fruit, demonstrating once again by Yahweh's power as a sign that Aaron is the priest. And verses 12 to 13, the people of Israel, I think, finally sort of kind of get it in their stumbling way. They said to Moses, behold, we perish. We are undone. We are all undone. Everyone who comes near, that phrase again, who comes near to the tabernacle of Yahweh shall die. Are we all to perish? They finally understand that the presence of God is not something to be manipulated. So now what? As I wrestled with this passage this week, that question, is it too small a thing? When you think about what it is that we've been called to, when you think about what it is that God has done, we sang about it this morning. We said it in our statement of faith. We have been separated. Distance has been put because of our sin and rebellion between us and God. And God has seen fit to bridge that distance. He has seen fit to draw near and to be present in our midst. And his presence is powerful. His presence is the presence of life itself. It is a good thing. It is the best thing. It is the only thing to be in the presence of the living God, to be able to draw near. And the Levites and the Reubenites look at it and say, it's not enough. Moses asked them, is it too small a thing? And the answer is yes. For them it is. And for us, there are all of these temptations to think that what God has done in placing his Spirit within our hearts, within our congregation as the assembled people of God, is too small a thing. We tend to crave other things. We tend to crave power and control rather than yielding control to the one who indwells us. And so whether this is on the national scene with the situation, I think we all feel a sense that we have lost control with this election cycle. I sat there Monday night and thought to myself, one of these two people is going to be our next president. That's a sobering thought. And we want to change it. We want to fix it. We want to try to control it. We want to seize hold of that. And I have been challenged to ask the question, is it too small a thing that the God of the universe dwells within me and within us? Will my world really be rocked because I lose control or perceived control in this arena? We had the privilege and opportunity to be together with a group of pastors the last few days for a pastor's retreat, and one of the pastors was sharing, and he said, when people ask how things are going in my ministry, he says, the first thing that comes to mind is, well, it depends on what I choose to think about. On any given day, there are things that are going well, and there are things that are not going well. And I would imagine that's not just true in ministry, by the way. I would imagine that for each of us, if you ask, how are you doing? We all say, fine, because to think about it for very long, the answer gets very complex and nuanced. It depends what we choose to think about. And I would venture to guess that we tend to gauge our lives, how are things going, based on how things are going. When we ask that question, we suggest that it is too small a thing that the God of the universe has taken up residence in our hearts and lives. How are we doing? The God of the universe lives within me. I'm doing amazing. And everything else can take a back seat. It is what will prevent us from grasping and clinging to control and to power. See, this isn't really about authority, is it? It's not about Korah being jealous of Aaron. It's about Korah being jealous of God. He has despised Yahweh and thought that it is too small a thing that the God of the universe has dwelt among him. So we come to the table this morning. We come to the visible, tangible reminder that the God of the universe has taken up residence in our hearts. And I would ask us this morning as we approach the table, it's a small piece of cracker and it's a small cup of juice. And it's a brief observance that we mark once a month. Has it become too small a thing? In our church, are there things that we are attached to? In our lives, are there things that we are attached to where we say, yes, it's great that Jesus is here, but there's this or that or the other thing that I wish were different, that I wish I had more control over, that I wish I had more of a say over, whatever that situation is. And the task is that we become defined by the things that we do, and therefore by how successful those things we do are, rather than by this. But this is what we are to proclaim. This is what is to set us apart. The God of the universe became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have beheld his glory, glory as of the only begotten from the Father, full of grace and truth. Is it too small a thing for us? So as the men come forward to serve, would you join me in prayer? Father God, give us hearts that are larger. May it never be too small a thing that you have taken up residence within us, among us. May we not despise the tremendous blessing that we have, but may we gather around that presence confidently and gratefully for the grace that you show to dwell among us. Amen.